Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Want to make 75 grand at 23 with some slightly scary toys? Today, we go to drone school. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, May 23rd. Thanks for being here. President Obama gave a speech about American manufacturing today. Well, technically, it was a speech about the administration's drone strike policy and placing some new limits on it. But those drones are built by a rapidly growing U.S. industry. Marketplace's David Weinberg took a look around to see how big the drone business is.
It's tough to say exactly how big the drone industry is. A lot of the information is classified. But we do know that the Department of Defense budgeted $3.8 billion this year for drones, or as the industry calls them, unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs. Next year, that number will decrease. But this is an industry in its infancy.
And so ultimately, there's going to be a revival in spending in the United States on UAVs based on this reorientation.
Phil Finnegan is a director of market analysis at the Thiel Group. He says that as the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq wind down, the military wants new drones, specifically designed for other parts of the world, especially Asia.
The U.S. is looking at the development of new set of drones, which are able to penetrate defended airspace.
Finnegan says that as foreign governments start buying drones to keep up, the global demand will explode. And the best place to see the booming drone industry is San Diego.
San Diego has the lion's share, probably well north of 60% of total UAV activity in the United States when it comes to manufacturing and research and development.
Eric Bruvold studied the economic impact of the industry in San Diego, and his report found that $1.3 billion flowed into the county as a result of drone spending.
And that supports about 7,000 jobs in our county.
About 2,000 of those were aerospace jobs that pay about twice what the average private sector worker makes. The other 5,000 were indirect jobs that ranged from warehouse employees to waitresses.
Our expectation, with a fairly conservative estimate, is that UAV demand will double worldwide over the next 10 years.
That includes an increase in commercial drones. In 2015, the FAA plans to open U.S. airspace to drones. Farmers could use them to dust crops, police to pursue fugitives. And as the price of drones drops and individuals can afford them, there will no doubt be all kinds of things to do with a drone that we haven't thought of yet. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
As you just heard, it's pretty hard to fly a civilian drone in the U.S. right now. The regulations are still being worked out. But with all the money pouring into the industry, a few enterprising schools are offering students a chance to make this a career. Yeah, you can major in drones. Ben Trapnell teaches at the Center for Unmanned Aircraft Systems at the University of North Dakota. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate being here.
I'm curious what your graduates go on to do. What kind of jobs do they get? How much money do they make?
Well, it all depends. There's not a great deal of civil use in the United States outside of law enforcement and first responders. So a lot of the students are working with civil contractors that are providing services for the military. And with regard to pay, some of the word that's gotten back to us at the university is the students are starting anywhere from about $60,000 to $70,000 a year.
Not bad coming out of school.
No, not bad at all.
I wonder, when you look at some of the work that your graduates are doing, does any of it give you moral pause? Do you think I am training people to be high-tech mercenaries?
Okay, first of all, let me say that none of the students that we have graduated are going to work with unmanned aircraft systems that are armed. Not a single one of them has flown an armed unmanned aircraft. So in regard to there being mercenaries, that's about as far away from the truth as I can imagine.
But they are working with military contractors, some of them.
They're working with military contractors that are providing intelligence that is used to help people that are actually on the ground to execute their missions. They are not in any way, shape, or form acting in a way that is being used to target a missile or something like that.
Hmm. The speech the president gave today, does that affect your future? Will that affect your graduates?
Not that I'm aware of. There's a lot going on politically in Washington, and I can't do anything about that. What I can do is try to provide operators for unmanned aircraft systems that are aware of the regulations that exist for manned aviation. I absolutely believe that unmanned aircraft systems will have more money invested in them from a civil context than they ever did from a military context.
I'm also curious about one thing. You don't like the D word. You don't like the
word
drone.
I think the term drone creates a lot of hate and discontent in certain people's minds. They get afraid of it.
How many years until you or I is driving down the street and there is a drone, an unmanned aircraft overhead, and it's not weird?
To me, it shouldn't be weird. But if it's done in the right way, I would say that in the next 5 to 10 years, it'll become an everyday kind of thing. I absolutely believe that when you start seeing unmanned aircraft acting more as a guardian angel than a weird spy tool, then it's going to be an everyday kind of thing that nobody's going to think twice about.
Ben Trapnell teaches at the Center for Unmanned Aircraft Systems at the University of North Dakota. Ben, thank you very much for joining us.
You're more than welcome. Thank you.
Two things seem to move the markets these days. One man.
Fiscal policy for the last few years has actually been a significant headwind to recovery rather than a supporting tailwind.
Yeah, that's Ben Bernanke, the Fed chair. The other thing that moves markets is a country, China. Today, a slowdown in Chinese manufacturing spooked markets, especially next door in Japan. Don't get all freaked out, though. U.S. markets went down, up, and were basically flat. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Remember back about a month ago when the Associated Press's Twitter feed suddenly said there'd been an explosion at the White House? Well, it wasn't true, of course, but that fake tweet caused some panic and sent the Dow down 143 points. Today, Twitter announced a two-step authentication process. That means if you opt in, a password alone won't get you into your account. Probably good news for Burger King, Jeep, or anyone else whose Twitter has been hacked. Marketplace's Queena Kim says it could also be the beginning of the end of the password.
Authentication in computer speak is simply proving you are who you say you are. Right now, we do this by using a password. Doug Tiger is a computer science professor at UC Berkeley. He says if you sign up for Twitter's new service, it'll require a second verification.
You get an SMS message on your cell phone, and it'll have a 6-digit code, and you enter it to authenticate yourself.
PayPal and lots of financial institutions are already making similar services available. But the problem with passwords is human error and having to remember so many of them. Doug Song is CEO of Duo Security. He says despite repeated warnings, people use easy passwords over multiple sites.
And so the realization, I think, has been that there has to be something stronger to protect those accounts.
So tech companies are trying to get rid of the password. Facebook's been experimenting with asking you to ID photos of your friends. And UC Berkeley's Tiger says
other people have proposed using biometrics, which would depend on measuring cornea scan or a handprint, or one of my colleagues here has proposed using brainwaves.
I don't think the password's going anywhere.
Alex Salazar is CEO of the digital security company Stormpath.
Many of these other forms of authentication that people are experimenting with do require an additional step, two or three, and you don't see a lot of appetite for consumers.
He says until technology makes it as simple as punching 1234 into your Netflix account, most consumers won't make the switch. In San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
Let's say, totally hypothetically, of course, that you drop your iPhone on a sidewalk or a slate floor or in a rest stop toilet in Louisiana. It gets expensive. Apple has sold more than 350 million iPhones since it first introduced them back in 2007. And so far, Americans have spent more than $6 billion fixing broken ones. Parts for the latest model, the iPhone 5, are even pricier than previous generations. We asked reporter Shannon Mullen to find out why.
iPhone users under 35 are apparently the clumsiest. Half of them have accidents that cause damage. That's according to a survey by the consumer electronics insurer SquareTrade. 24-year-old Elena Delvac lives in Los Angeles. She's broken the screen on almost every iPhone she's owned.
I did continue using my 3 for a long time until pieces of glass started coming off onto my face.
Delvac has an iPhone 4 now and paid $80 to fix the screen. She's thinking about upgrading to the 5, but it would cost even more to fix because there are fewer replacement parts available.
That for me is a huge deterrent because I drop my phone at least 4 times a week.
There's been lackluster demand for the iPhone 5 since it came out in September. Apple has cut orders for replacement parts, and they don't supply them to independent shops. So some repair companies are charging twice as much to fix iPhone 5 screens as they do to repair the 4. Kyle Weens is founder of iFixit.com, a site that supplies parts for electronics.
The parts have been difficult for people to manufacture, and we haven't gotten enough of them out in the marketplace where the price of used phones has come down to the point where we can cannibalize used phones for the parts.
Weens says Apple controls the repair price so they can steer people into upgrading their phones instead of getting them fixed. Others accuse Apple of trying to corner more of the lucrative iPhone repair market. But Gartner tech analyst Hughes de Laverne doesn't suspect any foul play.
Apple's got a pretty good reputation with their end users, and I don't think they would risk a black eye that would come from something like that.
Apple declined to comment, but pointed to reports on the durability of the iPhone versus its competitors. I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
If you've hired a plumber anytime recently, you may have taken a look at the bill and wondered, yay, why didn't I become a plumber? The money's good, the jobs are there, and a lot of the education comes debt-free. So why don't more young people opt to go to school for 2 years to learn a trade? Gigi Duban reports, it's a lot about image.
If there were an Indy 500 for construction, the National Craft Championship would be it. More than 100 plumbers, carpenters, metal workers, and electricians facing off in a competition that's all about skill and speed. They had 6 hours to finish a job, and then time was up. 28-year-old Holly Thomas, defending her gold medal, charged through her welding task. She finished 90 minutes before the clock ran out. Talking to her afterward, she sounded like she just played in the Super Bowl.
I came in here and I gave it 100%, and I feel good about what I did.
Holly makes welding sound really simple.
Pretty much, we take 2 pieces of pipe that are beveled, and you put them together, you leave a gap in between the 2 pieces of pipe, and you have to weld it up.
And that's part of the problem. The assumption a lot of people have about trades like welding is that you don't have to be very smart to do them, which is the challenge Holly and others in her profession face.
I mean, every one of these guys are mathematicians. I mean, there's not a craft here that doesn't require high-end math skills.
That's Greg Sizemore, who headed up the craft competition.
So to think that this is an unskilled trade is probably the furthest thing from the truth. We refer to these guys as craft professionals.
Sizemore isn't the only one working to change the perception of tradesmen. Holly's company, Houston-based KBR, sends Holly out to schools and camps and community colleges to spread the word.
Well, I think we have an image issue.
That's Tom Yuremovich, who heads up a nonprofit to promote careers in construction. He says when he was in high school, his teacher laid it out like this. Either go to college or become a ditch digger.
Ditch digger today climbs into a $500,000 piece of equipment, closes the doors, turns on the air conditioner, and pulls levers almost like a video game and goes home at the end of the day just as clean as he started the day.
Yuremovich says his group is trying to attract unemployed veterans and kids in urban areas to the field. He tells them college isn't the only path to a good career. And for many students, college comes with crushing debt and uncertain job prospects.
Or you have the young person that goes to work in the trades and within 4 years can be making $75,000 to $100,000 easily.
Jobs like pipe fitting, plumbing, and brick masonry are expected to be among the fastest growing occupations over the next decade. That's according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Community colleges are creating more programs geared toward trade careers, which is a good thing, given the huge demand for workers. Matthew Clark recruited Holly to his company, KBR, and gave her more training.
The stuff that we build is petroleum refineries, chemical refineries, and, I need 500 Hollies right now on a project in Louisiana.
Across the country, especially in regions where there's a lot of growth in energy and housing, thousands of positions are going unfilled. Tom Tveit is an economist with Garner Economics.
They're just begging for workers because they're seeing explosive growth in the double digits in construction employment.
Begging for workers? We haven't heard a lot of that lately. In Birmingham, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Coming up, to me it seemed like it was almost like this proactive spending. If you could say you're going to have to spend a certain amount for infertility, do it now versus spending a lot more later.
The very big business of egg freezing. But first, let's do the numbers. Some good housing news to help keep Wall Street steady after a big sell-off in global markets. The Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped 12 points, less than a tenth of a percent, to end at 15,294. The Nasdaq dipped 3 points, a tenth percent, to close at 3,459. And the S&P 500 ditched 4 points, about a quarter percent, to end at 1650. Stocks fell overseas on worries over economic slowing in China. The British FTSE, German DAX, and CAC 40 each lost 2%. Japan's Nikkei was the big story of the day. The index plunged 7%. Bond prices rose slightly. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.01%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. We'll get the latest economic report from the Commerce Department. This time, it's durable goods for the month of April. Abercrombie & Fitch release earnings. We'll see if a comment from their CEO about going after the cool kids hurt sales. And Disney theme parks celebrate the start of the summer season. They'll be open for 24 hours straight. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. Let's talk clout. With a K. That's the company that ranks your online influence on a scale from 1 to 100 based on things like Twitter popularity. Shocker, Justin Bieber's up there at the top. The company wants those high-profile people, called influencers, to become magnets for online ads. As Stacey Vanek-Smith explains, clout's latest bid is to create a better search engine.
Say you have a question, like how to roast a chicken or what catnip does. Clout wants to pair you up with someone who can answer it. Joe Fernandez is the CEO of Clout.
When you do these searches, you don't always just want a bunch of articles. Sometimes you want to connect with a person.
So if you're planning your honeymoon and want to know which Hawaiian island to visit, you can just pull out your phone, type the question into Bing, and get a personal answer from a travel expert. Fernandez thinks this format will be more attractive to advertisers than traditional search.
Taking an answer from an expert, somebody who is built reputation and is trusted about the subject, and sponsoring it is a powerful brand tool.
Targeted ads will appear around the Bing answer, and Fernandez says Clout is working with brands to sponsor experts as another way to grow sales. Facebook, Google, and LinkedIn all tried their hands at Q&A search, but couldn't make it work. Now Clout and other startups want to crack the code, says David Evans, a social media researcher.
The question and answer type service is getting to be one of the darling puzzles of social computing.
Evans says Clout is in a unique position to make Q&A search work because it spent 5 years identifying who people turn to for certain topics online. And those experts are often regular people.
And today we're learning some tips on how to maintain and keep up your sustainable garden.
Yolanda Van Veen is a student, mother, and clout-anointed gardening expert in Washington State. Millions of people have watched her online videos. She answers about 10 clout questions per week. She isn't paid for her expertise, but says the time investment is worth it.
Maybe you're not making, you know, $1,000 consulting fee, but in the end, I'm getting that following.
Clout rewards its experts with a higher clout score.
You know, I'm a single mom, and I can answer clout questions from my cell phone at the river. And, you know, the kids are so cute because they'll tell people sometimes, my mom's famous on the internet, but nobody knows about it.
Q&A search has big advertising potential, says James Fowler, a social media professor at UC San Diego. Still, he says, pairing advertisers with the answers is backwards.
Targeting involves having an understanding not of the person who's being searched, but of the person who's doing the searching.
Fowler says clout ads are built around the expert. So a question about frying pans might have an answer sponsored by Williams-Sonoma, when the person asking might have more of a Sears budget. Fowler says in this type of search, the best answer for advertisers is to know who's asking the question. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Most people who seek out a fertility doctor are couples who've had trouble conceiving. But a growing number of women are going in alone. Not to try to have a kid now, but maybe a little insurance for later. They're freezing their eggs, maybe at 35, to try to use them in a few years. And like you'd imagine, the process can be invasive and expensive. Sarah Elizabeth Richards wrote a book about it. It's called Motherhood Rescheduled: The New Frontier of Egg Freezing and the Women Who Tried It. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So this is a new industry that really didn't exist, even as recently as maybe even 5 years ago. Talk to me a little bit about how this grew up.
Well, it didn't really become available in the U.S. till about 2002, 2004. And we've seen most of the growth in the last couple of years. There's a study showing that more than half of fertility clinics now offer egg freezing. And then we've also been experiencing a cultural moment with egg freezing. A lot of celebrities have started to talk about it. You know, when Kim Kardashian says on her reality show, gosh, maybe I should freeze my eggs. I mean, that's a big moment, unfortunately, in our culture. But I think that, you know, sent a signal that, hey, gosh, this is real and a lot more women are considering it.
You yourself did this, what, 8 times, spent $50,000?
Mm-hmm. I was on the frequent freezer plan.
That's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money. I had to make trade-offs. Obviously, I had to choose to spend that money on that versus, you know, vacations or down payments or cars. You know, I didn't want to be in my mid-40s and spending, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars on IVF rounds that might not work. To me, it seemed like it was almost like this proactive spending. If you could say you're going to have to spend a certain amount for infertility, do it now versus spending a lot more later.
The women in your book, do you think they got what they paid for?
That's a good question. Some did in terms of babies, some didn't. What was interesting is the ones who didn't still found ways to be moms. And I asked them in the end, I said, did you regret it? And they said no, because I felt better about my decision. And the years after you freeze until, let's say, you know, get married or have a baby or whatever life path you choose, I mean, those are years without anxiety.
How do you pay for all this?
I paid for part of it myself. I pretty much depleted my savings. One of the women in my book, she put it all on a credit card. She didn't want to use up her savings. And all of a sudden, one of those credit card offers appeared in the mail. And she's like, this is it. This is how I'm going to pay for it. And I asked her once, I said, well, you know, how do you feel making that payment every single month? She says, actually, it didn't bother me because I felt like it was a reminder of a good decision I had made. I felt really proud of freezing my eggs and sort of taking control of my fertility.
I want to be clear with listeners that I froze my eggs about 2 years ago because of some health problems that I had. But you're also advocating this for a broad swath of women. And this is new technology. We don't really know yet what's going to happen. Do you think that's worth it?
For me, it was worth it. You know, success rates are much better now. They're almost the same rates as for some of the best doctors as using fresh eggs and IVF.
When you look out a few years from now, where do you see this industry going?
I'm hoping because it becomes more popular, a lot more women are going to do it, and that the really good clinics are going to stand out. And that, you know, hopefully with more competition, you know, the prices will go down and it'll become available to a lot more women.
Sarah Elizabeth Richards is the author of Motherhood Rescheduled, The New Frontier of Egg Freezing, and The Women Who Tried It. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, if you want to make some money, listen to this. That is the sound of the Brood 2 17-year cicada, emerging soon on the East Coast to do what all 17-year-olds try to do, look for a mate. It also turns out that cicadas are actually pretty decent market forecasters. Going all the way back to 1928, a cicada year was good for stocks, according to MarketWatch. Brood 2 years posted a market gain of 21%. That's about twice the historical average. So think of that when they're crunching under your feet or dive-bombing you from overhead. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow slipped 12 points, a tenth of a percent. The NASDAQ dipped 3 points, also a tenth percent. And the S&P 500 ditched 4 points, about a quarter percent. John Buckley, Kim Bowie, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. And I'm Lizzie O'Leary. We'll meet you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.